haven't seen him?
I think we have it in.
Yeah, don't make me nervous. You can go find the guy. Call him.
Could I have your attention, please? We'd like to get started, so if people would please take their seats, and we will begin the meeting of the Committee on Energy, Utilities, Technology, and Communications. And we do not have a quorum yet, but we will begin the meeting. If members would look in your folders, you'll see that there is a history and an overview on transmission. And today we're going to also hear from a member of, is it MISO, and CapEx 2020. So if Claire Moeller and Laura McCartan would please come to the table. Who would like to begin? Mr. Moeller.
Thank you. That way I can defer all the hard questions to Laura. My name is Claire Moeller. I'm with the Midwest Independent Transmission System Operator, sometimes called MISO. I'm delighted to be here today to share a few comments and answer what questions I can of this committee. In your packet, there is a slide deck that we'll be going through the first part of. We won't have time to go through them all, but it'll be kind of a conversation guide. What the Midwest ISO is obligated to do is a few things. We are a creature of federal regulation. We're charged with transmission planning, fair access to the transmission system, and we also operate an organized electric market. And there's a slide in a couple slides later. We'll talk about what that means. On page 3, there's a map that talks about the footprint that the Midwest ISO covers. All those blue things show customers of ours. We've got about 120,000 megawatt market. For perspective, the NSP load in Minnesota is about 9,000 megawatts. So NSP is, you know, almost 10%. Of the load in the entire Midwest ISO footprint. If I could direct your attention to slide 4, and this begins to get to the so what of an organized market and why it's beneficial to large-scale wind integration. What the market does and what transmission generation operators do and have done for a long time is ensure that the generation and the load matches. To the degree that the generation mismatches, signals have to be sent to the individual generators to reduce their output. And then conversely, when loads more than generation, those same kinds of signals go to the generators to increase. The Midwest ISO does that for the entire 115,000 megawatts. So as if we can go to slide 5, what's important about that is that among the problems that need to be solved in order to do a good job of integrating wind, wind's resource is fairly variable, and the notion of sending an output signal to the machine that says, I need you to send this much electricity to us, you can't do that very well. So instead, what happens is whatever the wind happens to be delivering, you have to take that generation and move some other generator to make room for it, either up or down, to keep that load balance that we talked about. The fact that the Midwest ISO is over 100,000 megawatts makes the ability to take 1,000 or 5,000 megawatts of wind and manage that variability effectively across the entire footprint. So that's what's important about being able to do that load following and contemplate integrating larger amounts of winds than what we've talked about to date. If I could direct your attention to slide 6. The Midwest ISO participated with the contractors for the wind integration study, and we were happy to do that. But it's important to point out a few things that wind integration study did not do. The wind integration study took a list of hypothetical transmission lines, things that were plausible in order to model years like 2011 and 2000, 15. Those are transmission lines that have not been built yet. Many of those transmission lines are outside of the state of Minnesota, and there is no commitment at this time to construct that transmission. So that's one of the things we need to worry about as we implement large-scale wind. What would be useful for us is the level of wind needs to be specified so we can get down to the work of actually designing a transmission system that could accommodate it. Also not in the study were the effects of what the neighboring states are doing or the nation. States adjacent to Minnesota, Wisconsin, and Iowa also have renewable portfolio standards. There's renewable portfolio standards pending in Michigan, Illinois, Indiana. The wind resources tend to be from Minnesota and west, and the folks that are interested in using wind as a resource tend to be from Minnesota and east. Those kinds of things were not in the study that was performed. That study made some assumptions about the neighboring states, but did not seek to construct a system to serve their needs too. To the degree we can coordinate the requirements of Minnesota with the requirements of the adjoining states, we can reduce the impact of transmission infrastructure on the citizens of all those states. That's why I bring that up. To slide 7, please. We see some decision risks that we'd like to bring to your attention as you deliberate the portfolio standard for Minnesota. One of those is there are construction issues around steel and cranes and linemen and field technicians to do this kinds of work. So we need to be mindful that we don't try to go too fast and overrun the capacity of both the turbine manufacturers and the transmission line construction suppliers and project management, so that we don't overrun the cost unnecessarily. Also, an important part of the study was a geographic distribution of the generation. That same variability that we talked about in terms of the Midwest ISO market helping manage that variability, another attribute is reducing the variability of wind. The best tool to reduce that variability is have those wind machines physically apart from one another. So as the wind front moves through, it doesn't affect all the machines at the same time. So that is another very important piece of the study and an important assumption. If we do something different than that, then we'll have to reevaluate and add additional technology and cost in order to manage that. The other thing that's important is the connection between this state and the rest of the Midwest ISO market. To give an example, the 25% penetration looks at about 5,700 megawatts of wind as the amount required to meet that kind of energy requirement. That's more capacity than the machines that Sherco 1, 2, and 3, Monticello, Prairie Island 1 and 2, and the King plant combined. So there are times when we have to make space for all of that kind of energy as it comes online. So the connection to the rest of the region, Wisconsin, Iowa, Illinois, on into Indiana, is important to allow us to move that energy on fairly short time frames back and forth so that we can maintain that balance. Which takes me to what our recommendation would be on slide 8. We would urge you to choose a target for Minnesota, and it's important to have time frames on those targets, but let's be careful to make that as soon as practical, not as soon as possible, because as soon as possible will cause some of those discontinuities and perhaps transmission lines that wouldn't be needed if we were more mindful about what was going on in the region around us. I think it would be appropriate to require the utilities and the Midwest ISO to show up at the Minnesota Commission with a specific plan on how a renewable portfolio standard would be accomplished, and I think it would be appropriate for the commission over time to review how we're doing in terms of making those commitments. I think it would be appropriate to use the structure that's in place in the biennial plans here in Minnesota as a place to house those kinds of investigations and simply increase the scope of those sorts of things so that we keep these investigations all in one place. The advantage of that is that that's the place where the balance of generation choices gets looked at between new combustion turbines, new wind machines, coal machines, relicensing, those sorts of things all happen in that biennial process. So that would be an appropriate place to continue to work. With that, I'd be open to your questions. There's other slides in your deck that are context that I don't believe it would be valuable to take you through them at this time.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Mueller. Maybe you tried to answer this question with slide four, but can you explain a little bit more about how long can you – is there a constant flow of electrons through in the transmission? How long can you retain it for a while, and how long do you have to ramp up if you have a surge or a need for more power? Okay.
I didn't answer it very clearly. It's a complicated question. First of all, there is no storage of electric energy, which is part of what causes the complication of the electric grid. So what has to happen is there has to be a series of signals sent to generators to ramp up and ramp down in very short time horizons, seconds, tenths of seconds, in order to try to always match that generation to load. So the actual quantity of electricity is always moving. The part of what you don't see in the electric system is as it moves, your clocks are going a little bit faster and a little bit slower. So what happens is if there's a large demand on the system, everybody's clock goes a hundredth of a second slower until the generation catches up with it. If a lot of load disappears, your clocks go a hundredth of a second faster until the signals catch up with the generation to make it go back. So that flow is always being adjusted over time. The machines themselves get adjusted in each of those time. There's typically a box on each generator called a governor that makes those adjustments in short amounts of time. Over the longer time horizon, there's a calculation called area control error. You might have heard someone say ACE. The area control error is a four-second time horizon that moves all the generation inside that 4 seconds. And then there's a third time horizon that the machines are adjusted at, and that's a five-minute time horizon. And that five-minute time horizon, typically utility guys will call load following because that's the more steady part of the load as it changes. For example, in the morning, as people come to work, the gross amount of generation needs to increase. That's that five-minute kind of time signal. You turning your light bulb on and off, that's the governor. And then the middle part of that is kind of the, you know, a foundry turning on or turning off its arc furnace.
But how about from the generation side? I mean, is there generation of power going on that isn't in the system that you tap into?
Yeah,
or does it flow through the system, and do you lose it without being able to utilize it?
Okay. There is never any generation that happens that isn't used somewhere, okay, even if it makes your clock go too fast. All right, so that's what happens and then the control equipment goes to slow that down. There are specifications about how much generation capacity has to be available and spinning so that you can move it up and down to catch these load swings.
Okay.
That's an operation that's called regulation reserve, spinning reserve. There is also a category called contingency reserve, which is if a big machine should fail, there's enough other generators in the system that within a short amount of time they can pick it up and keep that frequency balanced right there at 60.
And Why are there transmission lines outside of Minnesota? But can you explain that? Is that because what is the capacity of generation that comes into Minnesota?
Laura might be in a better position to answer that.
Okay.
The transfer capability into Minnesota, there is typically over 1,000 megawatts of energy that comes in from Canada, Manitoba. There is, at different times of the year, typically 1,000 or more megawatts that come into Minnesota from North and South Dakota. There are...
But are those transmission lines already there?
Yes, ma'am. They are there, and so they're fully utilized.
Maybe getting to the point then, if we're talking about wind generation or renewable resources within the state of Minnesota, is there still a need for transmission lines outside of Minnesota?
Depending on the location of, well, there's two pieces to that answer. One is you have to construct transmission from the actual source itself to Minnesota so that we can get it here. The second piece is between Minnesota and the neighboring states, we need the connection so that we can use a generator in Milwaukee to help load balance against the generation swings that occur with the wind machines. So, yes, we need those transmission connections.
Okay. Members, do you have questions at this time? Senator Sharon.
Is there also a need for the transmissions to other states in order for you to have a place to send energy that you're not utilizing?
Yes, ma'am. That's precisely what the Midwest ISO energy market was designed to do. Is ensure that the least cost generation is always available to the consumers.
Senator Jungbar.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One of the things I was trying to understand is if you have a transmission line, can you literally put up a wind generator or some form of generation and just tap in anywhere along the way, or if that's already maximum utilized, we need new transmission lines?
The transmission capacity that currently exists between, say, western Minnesota and here is fully utilized. Let me give you some examples on why that is. The total amount of customer load in the Buffalo Ridge area is on the order of 40 megawatts of load. The transmission system was built in the 50s predominantly, 40s and 50s, to serve that 40 megawatts of load. We currently have nearly 800 megawatts of generation there trying to use that system that was designed for 40 megawatts of load. So that's the mismatch that we're in here. The wind resources tend to be best where there isn't any load, so the infrastructure was never built that can accommodate the kinds of volumes that we're talking about here.
Okay. Any further questions?
Yes. Madam Chair.
Senator Dahl.
Thank you. Does it make a difference how far, how distant between the generation where it's used, or is that just push the energy down the line? How does that work with the grid?
Mr. Mueller.
You guys ask really good questions. the further away from the load that the generation is, the more complicated the transmission system has to be to get the energy here. Let me take you to a different analogy to help understand that. If you've ever driven down the road and hit a patch of ice and your wheels spin and you lose control of your car, what you had in engineering talk is a stability event. What happened is you had more energy going into the tires of your car than the road could handle. The further away generation gets from the load, the more opportunity there is for too much generation to be going in for the system to handle. And so it gets rather complicated in terms of how many transmission lines and where they go in order to avoid that kind of stability event. The large blackout on August 14, 2003, that took 50 million customers out in the eastern part of the U.S., they had too much generation going in that it wouldn't fit. So we like to be a little careful about that.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Mueller, are there advanced improvements on the transmission lines that would be able to accommodate?
Many of the advanced improvements are already in and in service, and that's how we've managed to serve the increasing load across the last two decades with very little additional transmission. The last significant transmission that was built into Minnesota was in the middle 80s from Manitoba. Those connections have just about every bell and whistle that has been invented in order to maximize its output. And currently, those systems are utilizing most of that technology in order to achieve the capacities that we have. That's how we've been able to avoid construction across the last 20 years.
Okay, Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Mueller, is there a federal commitment to the transmission lines, or what is their responsibility?
The primary responsibility of the federal government around transmission is to regulate its use in interstate commerce to avoid the abuse of market power by certain users. The first-come, first-serve use of the transmission system is governed by those federal rules. In terms of adequacy, there are opportunities for customers on the wholesale level, the interstate commerce level, to contend that a system is inadequate and the FERC can give an order to a utility to increase that capacity. But by and large, they're the owners of the rule set that talk about how you apply for service, how you get service, and it's currently a first-come, first-serve sort of regulatory paradigm inside the FERC open access transmission tariffs.
Okay, thank you. And at this time, we'll hear from Ms. McCartan.
Thank you, Senator. And thank you for the opportunity to be here. I am a co-executive director of the CapEx 2020 Transmission Initiative here in the state of Minnesota. So I'm going to give you some background on that initiative, a quick status of where we are with launching a significant investment in new transmission here in the state, and then offer some observations that we hope you'll find relevant as you proceed with examining and deciding the state's renewable energy policy. Going to the slide, I think it's number 6 in your packet, CapEx 2020 background. CapEx 2020 Transmission Initiative is a collaborative effort that began in 2004 when several Minnesota utilities came together recognizing that it had been a couple of decades since significant transmission had been built in the state and that there was a need to plan and develop new transmission here in Minnesota. And the new transmission is needed in order to ensure that the regional electric supply remains reliable. In other words, you turn on your lights and you get a light, to serve our customers' growing energy needs, and also to enable state renewable energy policy. The CapEx Consortium is unique and strong. It's a diverse group of the investor-owned utilities in the state of Minnesota, as well as cooperatives and municipal agencies that provide transmission service in the state. It's been a great experience to work with this group, and it is a these utilities have worked together, but not in this exact way, and this is something that is looked at across the nation as pretty exciting and unique. When the CapEx utilities came together in collaboration, one of the first things they recognized the need to do was to create a high-level conceptual plan of transmission needed in the state of Minnesota to serve these needs that I articulated earlier. In order to do this study, we identified the need to look out over a long time horizon, out to the year 2020, in order to really come up with an optimal concept and design for transmission for the state. We looked at a region that included the state of Minnesota as well as the surrounding states because of the fact that the transmission grid doesn't observe state boundaries. So we looked at the upper Midwest area concentrating on Minnesota. And a couple of assumptions that we made for our vision study is we used a future growth rate in customer electricity use of 2.47%, which is about what we had seen historically in this area. We also modeled a 10% renewable energy penetration by the year 2020. I think that we recognized that this was certainly a basement, and we just wanted to make an assumption and see what transmission facilities would result from these sets of assumptions. The next page I won't go into, but that's for your reference, is a list of all the utilities that
members,
are...
Members, this is actually, the next page is page 3 in your handout.
Sorry. Okay. Well, let me show you the page that I'm speaking of, which is titled CapEx 2020 Capacity Expansion by the Year 2020. It's a list of the utilities that are involved in this collaboration. So you can see that these are utilities that span the whole state in terms of providing transmission service. The next page is a list of what came out of that vision study, and I'll just show this so we're all on the same page. The CapEx vision study identified additional transmission facilities, high-voltage transmission facilities that would be needed in the state of Minnesota. Some of those we identified would be needed very soon, and those we grouped and called Group 1 projects. So those are the ones that have the most urgent need, and in fact, we have actually begun the implementation of the four Group 1 projects that you see there, and I'll speak about that more in a little bit. But just to let you know, those four projects, they're in very preliminary design stage. We need to go through regulatory review. We need to get route approval. Those things will help us then define actual mileage and better estimate of cost. But at this stage, our indicative cost for those four lines is about $1.3 billion, and they represent over 600 miles of new transmission line in the state. Group 2 is a not yet defined set of projects, but that would entail additional 345 lines, lines and substations around the Twin Cities area, and then possibly also extending out to the west of the Twin Cities. Group 3 is a set of transmission lines that also is not defined at this point, but that we recognize would be needed to connect to new generating plants and connect those plants to where the customer load is, in other words, with the concentration of customers in the need for electricity, such as the Twin Cities, such as any city in the state. Going to the next page, there's a schematic there of the state, and as I mentioned, the four projects that we call Group 1 projects, those are underway. We have begun the regulatory process for those four projects.
Actually a separate page in your handout. Oh, it is not.
I think we
don't have that page.
Well, then let me direct your attention to the page that you do have, which is the map of Minnesota.
This one?
Yes. On that map, you'll see that there are some shaded areas, and those shaded areas indicate roughly the four projects that we have begun implementation of. These four projects are needed for regional reliability. These have, as I mentioned, the urgent need. That's why we're proceeding with them now. They all work together to ensure reliability of electric supply in this region. And there's a synergy amongst all these four projects, so it's not, you just don't get the same outcome if you don't have all four projects going forward. These four lines also enable something on the order of 1,000 megawatts or more of renewable energy. Additional renewable energy from where we are today to be connected to the grid and to serve customers in the state. We did the analysis to identify what sort of transmission was needed given a variety of possible future developments in energy policy or generation development in the state, and we found that these four projects are essential building blocks. That is, whatever evolves in the state for energy policy or generation sources, these four lines are definitely needed, and then you build on that going forward. With these four lines, as I mentioned, we've started our regulatory process. The shaded lines you see on the map are generally indicative of what we call notice plan corridors. Within those corridors, everybody who lives there is notified so that they have the opportunity to participate in the regulatory process that looks at, are the lines needed? What's the appropriate route for these lines? What are the environmental impacts? That regulatory process we anticipate for the four lines would be something on the order of 3 to 5 years. And if they're approved, then there would be a multi-year construction period following that. Moving on to some considerations that we'd like to offer, given the experience that we had here to date and what we see ahead of us to bring these four Group 1 projects into fruition. As you look at the transmission needed to, which would be additional transmission, to meet the state's renewable energy policy, the first thing is we need to have detailed analysis to tell us exactly what to build. Mr. Moeller mentioned earlier the need for the analyses to integrate not only what's happening in the state of Minnesota, but what's happening within the MISO footprint so that we know that our plan can fit together with the larger regional view. The analyses would reflect state policies. For example, what is the renewable energy objective for the state? We'd put that in and go forward with that and coordinate, as I mentioned, with the Midwest Independent System Operator. Also, we need to ensure that we've incorporated the time to go through these reviews. These are critical. We've got, you know, even with these four projects, 600 miles plus of transmission line that are going to impact the public. We need time to engage the public in the regulatory reviews on need and on route. And finally, the last point is, as we are here in Minnesota looking at 600 plus miles of new transmission line with just the first part of CapEx, and we think that's a big deal, and it is a big deal, we also are aware that across the nation, very large transmission projects have been announced or are planned. And those projects will put a pressure on construction labor and materials and the availability of that really kind of going forward across the nation. So one of the things that we've recognized within the CapEx consortium is the need to develop a strategy to say, we anticipate this is going to be the case. How best can we manage it? And that will, I think, escalate as we look at more and more projects. Going to a couple of conclusions, one conclusion I'd like to leave you with is that the CapEx collaboration, this group of Minnesota utilities that came together, recognized the need for long-term planning, the need to collaborate together on that, and to tie into the regional view, is the appropriate vehicle to keep going forward with comprehensive state transmission planning and implementation. We've got a big task ahead of us to build the transmission to support the renewable energy objective. We, CapEx utilities, have the means to do it. We have the expertise. We have the energy to do it, and we want to be part of the solution. I want to put that in as a high point because now I want to just raise a sort of a caution or a flag just to help understand why we do want there to be some to keep going forward with some understanding of what it takes to get this all done. We do have concerns about the feasibility of putting in place all of the transmission by 2020 that would be needed for a 20 or 25% renewable objective. So the question is the time. How we can build it, but how long does it take us to get there? And I would echo Mr. Moeller's comment about if you try to do it too fast, you create some problems that you could otherwise avoid. The wind integration study, I think as everyone understands, was never intended to be a transmission plan study. There was a reasonable assumption made as to let's assume that this is the picture of transmission facilities available in the state. Now let's do the analysis on the effect of wind penetration. But a lot of that is conceptual, or much of it is conceptual. And when we look at and try to sort of add up the possible line mileage there, we come up with something on the order of 2,400 miles. I mean, it's a very rough approximation, reflecting the fact that a lot of those lines are conceptual only. But I talked about what we're looking at to put in place 600 miles of new lines with the Group 1 projects of CapEx. Now we're talking about 2,400 miles of new lines by, say, 2020. We have to understand that that would be a big impact on the regulatory resources, on the utility resources. And there would be a lot of simultaneous routing that would have to happen in the state of Minnesota. And then also we have to understand that to achieve the transmission for a Minnesota renewable objective, that requires transmission being built in other states. So we have to coordinate on a much wider area than just the state of Minnesota. So with those cautions, let me come back to the final point, which is still that the CapEx utilities are excited about being part of this, about building the new transmission that is needed to serve the renewable energy objective. We want to work with state policymakers and regulators to make that happen.
Okay, let me see if I've got this straight. You have 600 miles in the works already, and that will take from, did you say, 3.5 to 5 years to construct?
Madam Chair, it's correct. We have 600-plus miles in the works. We think a 3 to 5 year period is a good estimate just for the permitting. Once with the permitting is done and the approval is gained, then you have to build that 600-plus miles of new transmission, and that would be a multi-year period after that. Exactly how long, it's hard to say, but 3 to 5 years to get the approvals and then some number of years after that to get them built and operational.
And then you're suggesting that we need five times that amount in order to to be able to meet a renewable energy objective?
Madam Chair, I'm not sure exactly how much transmission would be needed, and that's why we should do a study. But what I was doing is, just as an approximation, looking at what was modeled in the wind integration study, how much new transmission was modeled in that study. And that amount of transmission is three or four times, it's hard to know for sure, of the, say, 600 miles that we are going forward with now, the total amount would be three to four times that.
Why do you think that the wind energy study or the wind integration study says that we would be able to meet a standard of 25% by 2020?
Madam Chair, my understanding is that that the study, in order to do a study, they had to make an assumption about what transmission would be available, knowing that the current level of transmission wouldn't be adequate, that they made a reasonable assumption about, they made an assumption about how much transmission would be in place by the year 2020. My understanding is that the wind integration study wasn't tasked with assuring that that transmission could be built, but was more tasked with trying to figure out the impacts of wind penetration overall in the system and what the operational and cost impacts of that would be. So I think that now that we have that wind integration study done and we have those conclusions, I think you move on to the next step, and the next step is put some specifically do an analysis what transmission needs to be built to support a renewable energy objective.
And you're estimating that the cost of all these transmission expansions will be $3.5 billion?
Madam Chair, the CapEx projects, is a very rough estimate, $3.5 billion, but that's very, as you can see, Group 2 and Group 3 projects are conceptual at best. There aren't the level of design on those projects that we even have for Group 1, and that is fairly uncertain. Also, my understanding is that the wind integration study assumed the CapEx projects and more.
Who pays for that?
Madam Chair, the cost of transmission would be reflected in customer rates. And, Madam Chair, if I could say, I guess my issue is not so much the cost. The cost will be what it is. The thing that I think we need to spend some more time on is how quickly can we build the transmission?
How much of CapEx is for wind energy? And how much of the expansion that you're looking at currently is for wind energy?
Madam Chair, the first four projects, which we call Group 1, are really for reliability primarily, to ensure that the grid is reliable and can provide reliable electric service. Those four lines together will also enable an additional 1,000 megawatts of renewable energy, such as wind energy.
Members, Senator Olsen.
Madam Chair, I'm just roughly calculating. Are you figuring like 200,000 a line mile for these lines?
Madam Chair, Senator, the cost per line will vary depending upon if it's going through a more urban area or a more rural area. But I think that the cost is much, much higher than that. Did you just take $1.3 billion and kind of go by 600?
That's a lot of zeros, too.
Yeah, it is. I think that we're looking at, and I'm going to look at my colleague over here so I don't say the wrong thing, is it something between 1 to 1 million plus per? Yeah, for the 345 kV voltage, it can be on the order of $1 million a mile, right?
I have a couple quick follow-ups. With these lines, you were talking earlier about the existing lines built to only a 40-kilowatt line. Would you just tear those down and rebuild newer lines over those same easements?
Ms. McCart.
Madam Chair, Senator, let me just speak to, I'm not going to speak to the 40-megawatt capacity out in the West, but let me speak to our intention as we build new lines. We try to use existing right-of-way wherever possible. Most of what we're talking about here are brand-new lines, though. So if what we're talking about with the CapEx and the high-voltage stuff is not necessarily tearing anything down, but it's adding more transmission facilities to the system.
And the last question,
Senator Olsen.
We've heard how some of these generators are now like 2.5 megawatts, so the capacity on those is growing exponentially. Is there growth in what you can run through, you know, how many lines you can run in a tower so you can get more capacity that way?
Ms. McCartan.
Madam Chair, Senator, I can't answer that question real well, so I think we'd like to try to get back to you on that. I think that we try to, through use of certain types of cable and tower structures, put high capacity there where we can, but there are other design considerations that come into play to say, how much energy do you want to transfer along that particular line. But let me just rather say that I'd like to follow up with you and get some technical experts who can better answer your question.
Just one question. You currently are mandated to comply with current law, and are you able to meet that mandate?
Madam Chair, could you refresh me on the mandate that you're speaking of in terms of the X percent by?
I'm going to call on Mr. Fuller.
Madam Chair, Ms. McAlpine, I think in 2005 and even previously there was direction to utilities to engage in planning for transmission to accommodate the renewable objective at that time. Have you done that, and are you looking forward to do more of that? I mean, there is a process in place and a mandate to do that.
Ms. McCartan.
Madam Chair, I don't think I can answer that question specifically, so if I could consult with someone to get you a correct answer, that's what I'd prefer to do.
Okay, we'd appreciate that.
I think we are. Okay. Do you want me to just take a second?
Sure. While they're coming.
Or should you want me to get back to you on that? Madam Chair, if I could just be sure that I've got the correct question. Your question is, are we meeting the current state mandate, state renewable standard?
That's
or are
correct.
We falling short of it?
No.
Well, transmission.
Madam Chair, the question is, we're talking about transmission, not generation. And in 2005, the industry came in and said, we need some tools to help us build transmission, cost recovery, criteria for granting certificate of needs, and there was specific direction under the transmission planning process, not the certificate of need process, to have plans for renewables proposed and certified. Is that happening?
That I don't know the answer to, so let me get the correct answer and get that back to the committee, if I may.
Okay. Thank Senator you. Dahl.
Madam Chairman, thank you. Ms. McCartan, this is for the ratepayers. Now, if most of the heavy lifting as far as the transmission line has to be in these remote areas where you haven't had the development, are those ratepayers going to be disproportionately affected by the costs, the way that CapEx is formed?
Ms. McCartan.
Madam Chair, Senator, no, I don't believe that our approach will put any disproportionate cost on customers. The customers will pay through their electric bills, reflecting the percentage that they actually rely on that new transmission.
Okay.
That answers your question.
Okay, thanks.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Anderson.
You know, Madam Chair, I know a lot of the community wind developers have told us over the years that they believe that they can put a lot of smaller wind projects online without the high voltage lines being in place. And I think there's probably a range of views about how many megawatts could be developed in the short term while the new high voltage lines are being built. But I think that's something that we need some information on, and we could ask if you have an opinion on that, how many megawatts of wind could be developed out before we have new high voltage transmission lines or before all of these are built. And I guess Madam Chair, maybe later we could get that testimony from some other sources as well.
Well, and are you able to comment on that?
Madam Chair, Senator, I would say that that is going to be a valuable part of the energy resource mix. Exactly how much and where, I don't know the answer to, and I would suggest that that's another factor, another piece of information that could be developed more specifically as we go forward and identify exactly how to meet the renewable energy objective through transmission and also how those projects would fit in with the overall grid.
Okay, Senator Anderson.
Madam Chair, maybe this goes back to what John Fuller was talking about a little bit, but especially for members who are new to the committee, in 2005 I carried the CapEx bill. It was part of an omnibus energy bill, and it was brought, all the utilities came together and asked us for authority to get faster rate recovery for their transmission building process because they made the case to us that we need more transmission to have a more reliable electric grid and to accommodate future growth in Minnesota's electricity needs. And, of course, the renewables issue, as Mr. Fuller said, have been on the table all along as well, and we've talked about accommodating that in along the way. But I'm wondering if you are on track to do what you came to us and got authority to do in 2005 or got support to do in 2005. Is that moving along as scheduled or,
Ms. McCartan,
or not?
Madam Chair, Senator Anderson, if your question is, are we proceeding now that the legislature passed the laws, I would say yes. If I'm understanding your question correctly, that's exactly what we're doing with the Group 1 projects. And a lot of that is not as apparent, I guess, but there's a lot of work behind the scenes, and we did initiate the regulatory process with the filing and the approval of the notice plans. We're working now very hard on putting together the certificate of need, which would be the next big step in implementing those transmission projects. We're putting together a lot of plans internally to make sure that we can do the right thing and do it well in terms of the public engagement. And we're looking at, you know, the 600-plus miles of possible route extension and saying that that's a big task. It needs to be done right because we need to make sure we engage correctly with the public. We're also pursuing a lot of things, strategies around this construction labor issue that I mentioned earlier. We're looking at how we can collaborate, not just one utility kind of going off and finding the resources, but how we can together find those resources and sort of, you know, tie them up or make sure they're here to work in Minnesota and they don't go off to do projects in Pennsylvania or California or Arizona. That's just a flavor of some of the things we are going forward on that. The law that the legislature passed last year was absolutely critical and is really fundamental in us being able to move forward.
Okay. Any further questions? Well, then I thank you for your testimony. If you get back to us on some of the questions that you were going to research further.
I will. I'm sorry I didn't have the answer, but thank you for your time.
Okay. And at this time, we'll begin bill hearings. There are four that will be coming before the committee. We will hear them one at a time. We will not be taking votes on them. They will be presented to you, and then we'll start with Senator Anderson.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair, and members. And I'm just sort of apologizing to Senator Rosen that I sometimes feel like a broken record because I've been talking about this bill for a long time. And so I hope I'm not repeating things some of you have heard me say over and over and over again. But hopefully, maybe this will be the last time I have to do it. And I want to thank the committee chairwoman, Senator Prettner-Solin, for giving this bill an early hearing. And sometimes it's hard to believe this is only the second week of session because we've been very busy. I will start. What I want to do is just give a few highlights in terms of why I think that the RES 25% bill is so critical to Minnesota, why we should pass it. I want to go through the bill, which is a fairly simple, I think, four-page bill. And then just go through, I have, I think, four frequently raised questions and issues that I about the bill that I wanted to comment on. And then Michael Noble is here to fill in and provide support if there's questions, I believe, or brief testimony. I think that this bill, the 25% renewable energy standard, is such an important bill for Minnesota's future, and it's such a positive bill because it brings together concerns about energy and the environment and the economy together, and it provides a winning formula for all of those areas. First of all, what this bill would do if we pass it in this form is to make Minnesota a national leader, if not the national leader, in renewable energy. We, in the last few years, have lost some of our leadership edge, and even Iowa is ahead of us in the wind production area. And we have an opportunity to get to the head of the pack if we pass this bill. Now there's 21 or 22 other states that already have a renewable energy standard in law, and so it's time for us to catch up. We have, in this bill in front of you, Senate File 4, we have one of the strongest bills for new renewable energy development in the nation if we pass it as written. We all know how important it is to turn our energy economy around and to do it in a way that will reduce our CO2 emissions and provide cleaner air and water for our citizens as well as for the nation, because all the decisions that we make, our air travels across state lines. And so we have, a moral obligation to do our part to try to reduce our CO2 emissions and reduce pollution from our energy production. And this is one of the most powerful ways we could do that without any cost to our taxpayers. One of the great benefits of doing it through a renewable energy standard, a market-driven bill, is that it will bring jobs and investment to our state. So we'll not only meet our environmental goals or begin to meet our environmental goals through our energy policy, we will also have the opportunity to bring thousands of new jobs to our state and literally billions of dollars of new investment to our state. We know we've heard a lot of testimony about this over the last few days, so just a few key points that were made. When you build renewable energy generation, you create a lot more jobs, 40% more jobs for the same amount of energy than if you're building a fossil fuel production facility. So it's very labor intensive, and these are high quality living wage jobs that can help sustain communities, especially rural communities across Minnesota. For example, Germany, which is one of the leaders in the world in their wind industry, they now have well over 40,000 jobs in renewable energy wind production in terms of manufacturing and other components, but they have far less wind than we do. They have something like a fifth the wind resources that Minnesota, the state of Minnesota, has. So we have a great opportunity here for an economic development. It's sort of a side benefit of an important energy policy. Finally, the issue of energy independence and energy diversity. I think it's critical for us to start to reverse our energy mix, because right now we're at about 70-75% coal, roughly 20% nuclear, and a small percent renewables. And it's important to have a more diversified energy system for security purposes, for reliability purposes, as well as for environmental consequences of that generation. And not only, as the president said, are we addicted to oil, but we also are very energy dependent in Minnesota when it comes to electricity. We actually import more electricity than any other state in the nation. And so we have an opportunity by bringing those jobs and investment to our state to have our energy dollars stay in our state, recirculate in our economy instead of being constantly shipped over our state lines and over our national boundaries. So those are some of the really compelling reasons why I think this is good policy for the state of Minnesota to pass. So I'd like to go through the bill. If you'll pull out Senate File 4. Does it say Senate File 4 on it? I just have a reviser copy. Thank you. I'm just going to go through section by section and tell you how the bill works. First of all, the first section you'll see is, well, just maybe a quick summary. Current law, under the current law, the renewable energy objective, which we passed in 2001,
This was a bill carried by Senator Metzen originally in the Senate. In fact, we started with a standard. That was our first standard that the Senate passed. It went to conference committee, and as a compromise, we ended up with the renewable energy objective, requiring utilities to make a good faith effort. And it started taking effect in 2005. So current law requires, starting in 2005, that our utilities across the state add 1% a year more renewable energy. And under the current law, they're on track to get to 10% by 2015. So what we do in this bill is keep current law up till 2010. And so the first thing that you would see in the – I'm already out of order here. Sorry. I already broke my rule here. I was going to go through the bill in order. But I'm going to jump ahead. Well, let me back up a little bit, and then I'll get to that. The first part of the bill, Subdivision 1, is the definitions. And we have some longstanding definitions under Minnesota law for what we count as eligible renewable technology. The only change in this definition that we have is to allow a hydroelectric small hydropower plant to be up to 100 megawatts. And it's still considered a small hydro plant. And it also includes sources such as wind, solar, biomass, municipal solid waste, hydrogen, and small hydropower. So that's current law with that one minor change. And then if you go ahead to the next section, Subdivision 2, and forward, it lays out the current law, the renewable energy objective. If you go to page 2, and under this objective, as it stands now, and this would be the same under the standard, utilities have a lot of options about how they obtain this renewable energy, and we are expecting to have more options as we get into trading. Under the current law, they can build the renewable energy generating facility themselves, or they can buy the energy, contract for the energy from a wind developer or from a community person or a group of farmers or anyone else who puts together a proposal to produce some kind of renewable generation. When we talk about this bill, we're mostly talking about wind because that's the most well-developed and competitive renewable energy source that we have right now. It's now cost-competitive with fossil fuels. But I expect over the next decade or two that some of the other sources that are listed in here will start to rise in their competitiveness and the prices will start to go down as the market demand grows. So under the subdivisions 2 and 2A, we take current law and allow that to continue till 2010. So the utilities have a period of time to make their adjustments and their plans. And then after 2010, we take away this 1% a year renewable steps and just leave it open to the utilities as to how do they get to the benchmarks. And we simply set some three very aggressive benchmarks into law, and you'll see that on page 2 in subdivision 2A. The benchmarks that they'd have to meet are in 2013, 11%, 2015, 15%, and 2020, 25%. But we take away those steps so that there's a little more flexibility about when. I mean, they could start building it now. Let's see. And then if you get towards the end of subdivision 2A, there's a couple of other changes in the new language. First of all, that we, in 2.29 to 2.31, we talk about energy that is from hydro or biomass that's been placed in service since 1975. And that's an issue that relates to, again, the definition of which renewable energy we count. And I'll talk about this more later, about why it's very important in this bill to focus on new renewable energy generation. And we're not very interested in counting what's already on the ground to get to this standard. And I'll get to that in a few minutes about why. The next language is very, very important at the bottom of page 2. And this was comes from an amendment that Senator Sparks offered in the committee 2 years ago when we passed this out of the last Energy Committee. And this is the off-ramp language, the language that allows the PUC to listen to concerns of the utilities based on three factors. One would be cost to ratepayers. Second would be if the requirements under the standard would impair reliability. And thirdly, if it would affect if it's not technically feasible to meet this. So a utility could go to the PUC, and if they could make the case that they could not comply with the requirements because of any of these three reasons, then this requires the PUC to delay or modify the standard for that utility. I probably didn't mention that we, in all through this, we change, after 2010, we change objective to standard. That's kind of a basic element of the bill. So this off-ramp language is very important to provide some of that flexibility that we've talked about over the last couple of weeks, that the utilities need to be able to accommodate unforeseen circumstances if they're simply not able to meet their requirements under this law. And it's, you know, we could discuss, there's Senator Prettner-Solin has a version of this in her bill, and there may be some ways we could modify this to improve the language. But I think the concept is really important to have a process at the PUC. So I really support that. Let's see. The following sections are essentially, there's eliminating some unnecessary language on page 3 and adding the word standard wherever objective appears. On the bottom of page 4, you see some stricken language, and that essentially strikes the current law, which sets up a different standard for Xcel. And for the new members, anytime you see the public utility that owns the Prairie Island Nuclear Generation Plant, that would be Xcel Energy. That's our indirect way of saying Xcel Energy in statute. So this would take away, because they currently have their own standard, they have a stricter standard than all the other utilities under law, under the renewable energy objective, and we take that away and just put them on the same plateau as all the other utilities under this law. Let's see. Finally, the compliance language. And this is new this year. We did not have this in last year's bill. And this is something that we share with the governor's bill. And again, there's some differences in exactly how it's worded and how it would work. But the basic idea is that the PUC would have to review compliance. And the way we set it up is, you know, we hope that a utility would meet the standards, just like they've met the renewable energy objective. And if they can't build it, if they can't buy it, and if they can't buy credits for it, or they don't do any of those things, and they're not making a showing that they can't do it under the off-ramp language, only then would the PUC have the authority to order compliance. And then if they still don't comply, then the PUC would have the power to impose financial penalties. You know, I really don't think that these are in place because we expect to get financial penalties, because I would say that in the history of the REO, it's a fairly short history since it actually took effect in 2005, but we've had very good compliance, and I think all the utilities in our state have made a very good effort to meet the requirements of the REO. And I think the governor, in coming forward with a proposal that puts compliance and penalties in place, makes his bill this close to being a standard. I mean, it's really sort of a matter of terminology more than it is of substance. So I think that's important to emphasize, that this is there as a backup to make it clear that we're serious and we mean it. But I wouldn't expect that, I would hope and expect that the utilities would get this done without having to get there. And if they do have a genuine difficulty or inability to meet the law, we have the language that I mentioned earlier in the PUC where they can find an exemption if necessary. So that's really the bill. It's pretty simple in how it's constructed. And if there's any questions, I'd be glad to answer those. But let me just, if I can, just make a few more final points about some of the big questions that people always ask about the bill. First of all, why a standard? Why not just keep the current law and have an objective? And I think there's some very good reasons for that, even though I do believe that with the governor's proposal to strengthen the REO, it's very, very close to my proposal to have a standard. But I think having the word in law matters. And the reason it matters is that it sends a signal to Minnesota developers and to the nation, as I think Dave Foster said, that we're open for green business, that we are serious about this, that we are going to have a consistent, stable, long-term policy on renewable energy that is unambiguous and clear. And one of the things that we hear a lot from wind developers is that there's been such inconsistent public policy in this area. We heard that from John Dunlop, who testified in the last committee, that it's actually added to the cost of wind development, having public policies that come and go. And if we have a standard in place, that sends a signal to the public and to the wind industry. To them, that means they can rely on this, and they can take it to the bank, literally. And this is going to be the state where they want to invest, because they're going to know that this standard is in place and that they have a long-term market in this state. And I think we heard someone else testify that for the smaller local developers in particular, this gives them the long-range time frame that allows them to plan and put together a package, which is not an easy thing to do, and to put together the financing. We know on a standard that it makes a difference in those business decisions. We know that Gamesa, for example, is a Spanish wind turbine manufacturing plant that looked at a number of states, and they looked at the Iron Range as one possible place to site their manufacturing plant. Well, they didn't pick us. They picked Pennsylvania, and they just opened that plant, I think, with something like 1,000 good-paying manufacturing jobs. And it just makes me want to cry that they're not here up on the range where we need those jobs. And they said, the head of that company said that the fact that Pennsylvania had a standard made was a part of their decision, was an important factor in their decision. And the last piece I guess I would say about the difference between a standard and an objective. I mentioned it's unambiguous, it's clear, it's certain. The REO, I think, could spend more time in the Public Utilities Commission and have, you know, be more of a lawyer's dream, spending time, hours and hours litigating and arguing about what does it really mean and what is a good faith effort. So its simplicity is very attractive. Okay, second big issue. I only have four, so I'm on number two. Why do our definitions of what's eligible to be called renewable, why do we exclude the old stuff? Because, yeah, hydro is renewable, and the wind that is already on the ground, it's renewable. That's not the question. The question is, what are we trying to accomplish with this law? And we're trying to accomplish, I'd say, two big things. First big thing is to stimulate the development of the renewable industry in Minnesota. Bring those jobs, bring those dollars to our state. The second thing we're trying to accomplish, and you can maybe have different opinions about which is more important, but is to reduce emissions. And if we are serious about reducing CO2 emissions, all those renewables that are already in place, those are part of our current amount of CO2 emissions. If we want to reduce CO2 emissions, we have to have new renewable energy development to offset our CO2 emissions and to reduce Minnesota's contribution to those. So if we're serious about trying to reduce CO2 emissions, this is about developing more renewable energy, not just kind of patting ourselves on the back for what we've already done, as great as it is. So it's critical to have it be new renewable energy, and that's what would make this a nation-leading law. It also provides more of a level playing field. I mean, the utilities in our state are all differently situated in, well, Xcel, of course, has all kinds of laws in place that affect it alone, and part of those are a quid pro quo for previous decisions that were made relating to nuclear waste, et cetera. But if we counted all the old hydro, for example, some utilities would be done. I think there's at least one utility in Minnesota that would be done. They'd be at their 25% as soon as we passed the bill, and some would have none. So it's not really fair to pick and choose, because there'd be more winners and losers that way. So, and I guess the last thing I'd say about counting the old stuff is that if we do want to incorporate that into our standard, you know, I'd be really open to that if we can raise the number. And, you know, if we count XL's things that are not included here, if we count their renewables that are not included here, well, they're going to be at higher than 25%. And that's a great thing. And so we could talk about making that a higher number. Okay, third issue. How do we help Minnesota, local Minnesotans, farmers, community members from around our state, community energy develop with our renewable energy policy? And there's been some tension about who's benefiting from all this development. And it'd be nice to see as much of the dollar that's spent stay in our state. And I guess what I would say is, first of all, Minnesota, we've really led the way on promoting and supporting community-based energy. We have had our own state incentive for small wind projects on the books for years. That money's just gone so fast that we haven't been able to keep up with the demand. We had set-asides for small wind projects in the 2003 Prairie Island bill. We passed, I was the author of the bill, part of the transmission bill we passed in 2005 also created the seabed law, which sets up the tariff for local small wind projects and to allow them to have better financing to get the capital costs covered for their projects. So we've done a lot, but we need to do more, and I think that's something that I consider a high priority this session, to make sure that we go the next step to try to support community energy as much as we can in the mix. And I know there's lots of negotiations ongoing between all the players in the wind industry, and I'm hoping that we can get some resolution on that. And we need to put that in a bill that I'm sure our chairperson is going to spend time on, along with our other energy issues. So that's something that we, and the transmission issues are a big part of that, making sure that they have access to transmission. So that's a critical issue. I'm not sure that it's quite ready to go in this bill, but it's definitely ready to go this session, and we need to move forward this session. Okay, finally, last big issue that you hear a lot, cost. Is it going to cost more to do all these renewables? And my answer would be no. I haven't seen any evidence that it will cost more, and I've seen a lot of evidence that it'll cost less. First of all, we know this will be mostly wind. As I said, wind is now cost competitive with fossil fuels, and so we know we can do the wind. We have the ability to provide, we have enough wind to generate 10 times more than we actually use in electricity in Minnesota. So we could do it all with wind. But hopefully some of these other industries will get jump-started by having this market demand as well. There's a couple of national studies that have been done that show that consumers will actually save money when you have a standard of 20% or more, and that putting more renewables into the system are actually a hedge against future energy price increases. For example, we know that the cost of coal is going to go up, given the inevitability of carbon restrictions. And we know they're talking about that in Congress right now. There will be legislation at the national level to restrict carbon dioxide emissions. I mean, that's a when, not an if. We know it will happen. And so renewables will look better and better in terms of cost as we go into the future. We know that some of our major utilities have already said that incorporating more renewables into their portfolio has saved money for their ratepayers. We've heard that from, I think, Great River Energy and XL. They have made statements to that effect. We know that our Commerce Department directed XL or asked XL to put more renewables into their latest mix to try to reduce the costs for ratepayers. So we have lots of reasons to think that renewables are going to save us money, and I think that will, when you have this kind of market-driven system, the demand is going to, I think, what it should do, what the economists would say, is the more demand there is, the more the prices are going to go down, and it's also going to drive the manufacturing of the components and the parts that are needed to make it possible for the industry to grow. And we know that uncertain policy has actually driven up costs. So then the very last thing I want to say is that I think this is a really important bill. I'm excited to hopefully pass it this session and move us forward. But it's not the only answer to our energy policy needs of the future. It's a piece of the puzzle. And I just want to mention briefly that there will be legislation on community wind, on transmission, on CO2 reduction, energy efficiency, and biofuels. Those are all coming, and you know, fasten your seatbelts, folks. It's going to be a busy year, and we have a lot to talk about. So this isn't going to solve all of our problems in Minnesota, but it's going to get us a lot of benefits for our state. So with that, I'd be happy to take any questions. Or do you have something prepared to say? Okay. Could Mr. Noble just talk very briefly?
Yeah, very briefly,
okay.
Mr. Noble.
Can I talk too long?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Michael Noble, and I'm with the nonprofit group Fresh Energy, and I'm here today on behalf of the coalition of groups working on this issue called Clean Energy Minnesota. I won't read all the group's name. There's a dozen groups working on the steering committee.
Mr. Noble, I just want you to know we're not here to testify on the bill, just explain the bill at this time.
I understood that.
Okay.
So a few points I wanted to amplify. I think Senator Anderson more than covered the main issues, but a few points I wanted to amplify here is that what Senator Anderson's bill does is it creates a market. It creates a renewable energy market. It's not about government bureaucracy or government mandates or government rules. It's about the state of Minnesota saying we're going to have a vigorous and competitive market for renewable energy producers to compete in. We're going to set the rules of the market, and we're going to get out of the way. And I think that's a good role for government and a good role for this committee to move forward with. We're going to create a market if it were all wind energy. And I agree with Senator Anderson that it's not, that many, many technologies are going to be coming around in the next decade or more. But if it were just wind energy, it would be about a 6,000 megawatt wind energy market, which is a big market. It's about a $7 to $8 billion market. And so people might say, uh-oh, that sounds like an expensive thing, that we're agreeing that we're going to create a renewable energy market of $7 to $8 billion. But what we're doing is we're attracting $7 to $8 billion worth of private investment that we need anyway, because we have growing needs for energy. And if we don't create a renewable energy market, it'll be a fossil fuel market. So that's what we're doing, is we're deciding to have a competitive renewable energy market of $7 or $8 billion instead of a fossil fuel market of $7 or $8 billion. That's what we're doing here today. And there's no evidence on the record that this is going to raise people's rates. There's no evidence on the record that the renewable energy costs more than the fossil fuels. In fact, as Senator Anderson said, renewable energy is a hedge against the cost of fossil fuels, because when you buy renewable energy, you know your capital cost, you pay it up front, you know your loan rate, your interest rate, and you know your fuel cost. Your fuel cost is zero. Forever. And when you buy fossil fuel energy, you know your capital cost, and you have no idea what your fuel cost is going to be, and you have no idea what your government regulations are going to be to handle the emissions. So here we have a situation where these two technologies, fossil and renewable, are neck and neck, but renewable has all the advantage in the world in that we know what it's going to cost going forward, and on the fossil side, we don't. The one other thing I want to point out is that the 6,000 megawatts of renewable energy, if it were, again, all wind energy, which we fully expect it won't be, the system can completely handle that. That was the net result you got from the wind integration study, is if you push Minnesota's electricity system up to 25% wind energy alone, the system can handle it. It doesn't impose big costs on the system. It doesn't make the lights flicker. You know, what do you do when the wind doesn't blow? That's what you paid. Ratepayers paid almost $1 million to find out the answer to that question, and the answer was it's going to work fine. So the idea that wind is a variable or it's intermittent or we can't count on it, that question's been answered for you by the study that the legislature commissioned 2 years ago. There's not a substantial cost impact, and there's not a reliability impact. So you don't have to worry about those two things. The last thing I want to say is that you know, transmission is a big part of the puzzle, and I'm really glad that you had MISO here and you had CapEx here, because transmission is a big part of the puzzle. But transmission is a big part of a puzzle whatever direction you go. If you have a future that is mostly dominated by fossil, you got big transmission issues there too. So whichever route you take, you have transmission challenges. And lastly, no person in this Capitol has been more committed to the community energy agenda than Senator Anderson. And the idea that somehow the renewable energy standard bill that she's advancing today doesn't have a community energy provision. There's plenty of time for community energy debates. Senator Anderson's passed no less than four bills that put Minnesota in the leadership position on community energy nationwide. And she's telling community energy activists that let's do it again this year, find the best thing to move the community energy agenda forward. And the idea that somehow this bill isn't complete because it doesn't have community energy provision, that's really not fair. So with that, on behalf of Clean Energy Minnesota, I think you have a good bill in front of you, at least for discussion point.
And I just want to mention, too, there is a small community energy portion in my bill when I bring it forward, but I expect that we will take that out of the bill and deal with community energy at a different time later in the session. So I appreciate the comments that you've made and the foundation that you've laid, which is a good foundation for all the bills. Are there any questions or comments at this time? Okay, thank you.
Okay, thank you very much.
And I see that Senator Tomasoni has come in. Okay. So we're going to hear his bill next. And Senator Tomasoni has a large bill that incorporates a number of different energy efficient and renewable energy issues, but we are only working off of the top of page 2 to the top of page 7, section 2 of Senate file number 129. And that's all that I want to hear today.
Madam Chair, you may be confusing that with the governor's bill.
No.
It isn't?
No.
I'm sorry. I'm sorry.
Can we see a copy of what you're... Got the same thing.
I don't have a copy.
Mr. Fuller did make a summary of that section of your bill.
Is it over here?
Oh, here we go. He's got it, Steve.
Madam Chair, in the meantime, maybe I can just make some opening comments. And
okay, Senator Tomasoni.
Mr. Oxley can comment on the summary. I just want to start off by saying that, as long as the Iron Range was brought up earlier, that we are ahead of the curve on getting into the renewable energies, and we have already started with the conversion of the Laurentian Energy Authority of converting the PUCs to biomass, and both projects are actually online and operating at this point in time. We also last year in the bonding bill appropriated some money for a wind energy park, and the idea was to actually try and construct some windmills and create jobs on the Iron Range also. So we're well aware of all of that. We obviously are also trying to do some IGCC, which is clean coal, and I personally believe that coal has to be a part of the equation because there are so many coal burning plants around, and I think it's one of the solutions because of the fact that we need to clean up the coal plants, and that particular one does it goes a long way to do it, and it's one of the only, the IGC is one of the only coal burning technologies that we know of that has the capability of sequestration. So I think I saw something from the state of Montana in regards to coal, which is interesting for our entire national plan in regards to our foreign dependence on fuels. And the numbers that I got are that just Montana alone has 1/3 of all the coal deposits in America, and that's 8% of all the coal in the world. And Montana's coal is roughly equivalent to 240 billion barrels of oil, which is enough to replace all our imported oil for 60 years. It obviously has to be something that has to be considered. But for purposes of this bill, I realize we're not talking about coal. So let me just get started on the bill. The renewable energy bill that I'm offering today is much like Senator Anderson's Senate File 4. It replaces the current voluntary 10% renewable energy objective with a mandatory renewable energy standard. Unlike Senate File 4, however, this bill makes the standard 20% by 2020 instead of 25%, and there are a few less significant differences as well, and they can be explained in further testimony here today. In addition, my bill contains provisions that go beyond the scope of Senate File 4 and Senate File 76 and beyond the governor's proposal. These provisions are intended to provide practical substance and legislative conformity to the renewable initiative that we pass out of the Senate this year. The substantive measures you will hear about concern matters brought to me by people in the industry and that I believe should be discussed and addressed legislatively within the context of the renewable energy initiative. Of these issues, some emerge simply as a result of the changing objective to the standard. There are statutes governing utility resource planning and the certificate of need proceedings that I feel should be examined before passing a renewable mandate. Furthermore, just about everyone agrees that Minnesota's electric transmission infrastructure is a significant issue that must be dealt with upfront as we consider changes to the state's renewable energy requirement. So, Madam Chair, if you permit, I'll introduce for further explanation of my bill Greg Oxley of the Minnesota Municipal Utilities Association, who can shed further light on these issues and answer questions from the committee. And one of the reasons I have this bill here, Madam Chair, is because while I realize we're heading toward this renewable standard, I think it's important that we have alternatives and that we don't be in too big a hurry to do this and make sure that we get it right.
Thank you, Senator Tomasoni. Mr. Oxley.
Yes, Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Greg Oxley. I represent the Minnesota Municipal Utilities Association, which is the trade association for municipal utilities of all types throughout the state. I won't explain my organization further because I did that last week. The legislation presented by Senator Tomasoni represents the efforts of our Government Relations Committee going back to last August. We decided at that time that it was obvious that Minnesota was going to move to some sort of renewable energy standard, and we wanted to get ahead of the game by having our own bill introduced, and we approached Senator Tomasoni and several of you to do it, and we appreciate their introduction very much. One of the things that we do is set a 20% renewable energy standard by the year 2020. That means that 20% of our sales by the year 2020 have to be renewable. That's going to require a monumental effort on our part. With all due respect to Senator Anderson, we feel that that's as far as we can go. But other than that, our standards are actually pretty close. The governor's standard goes 5% more 5 years later than we do, and his standard is pretty close as well. All four bills give specific authority to the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission to enforce the proposed renewable energy standard. This includes penalties and the authority to order action for noncompliance. The Minnesota Municipal Utilities approach goes a little farther. We have a consumer power district in South Dakota that inadvertently was left off the last bill in 2001, and we're bringing them into this bill because we think that we all should be part of this. We've talked to them. I think that they favor it, too. I think we all understand that we want to do what society wants based on what we're told to do by the legislature, and we're all part of this. The third thing that our particular bill does is, along with the Prettner-Solon bill and the Anderson bill, they give the commission the power to delay the imposition of renewable objectives on utilities for various reasons. These reasons, as Senator Anderson said, include situations in which compliance is not technically feasible, compliance would harm reliability, and compliance would hurt utility ratepayers. We just had a situation develop, for example, with the Northern Municipal Power Association, where they found that they could endanger their bonds because they would end up selling too much power for various reasons, or could end up selling too much power for various reasons to private entities, and that would violate some sort of federal standard. This is the kind of thing that we'd want the commission to look at. The MMUA bill cites a few other specific areas in which the commission would be allowed to order a temporary dispensation. I shouldn't use that word. I'm Catholic. These include non-delivery of needed equipment, transmission constraints, and the inability to secure the necessary permits to construct certain facilities. The Prettner-Solon bill allows the PUC to consider the extra issue of load growth of a utility and allowing delays in achieving those goals. We like that, too. It's not in our bill, perhaps should have been, because we have utilities that are growing at various rates and would probably have to put almost all their new generation and maybe generation they didn't need towards renewables. At this point, our bill diverges from others, and I was going to talk about it extensively, but that's not what you want to hear about tonight, and I'm going to cut this short. But let me add one thing without getting involved with testimony, which I know the committee doesn't want to hear yet. This is going to cost some money. It's going to cost – I don't know if it's going to cost more money for transmission than what we would have already spent, but we have heard estimates of 6 to 7 345 kV AC lines coming from the west. That's why the bill introduced by Senator Tomassoni, recommended by us, we're happy he listened to us on this, talks about making changes in the law that makes it easier to build those facilities. Because if we're going to make this work, we're going to have to build more transmission, and we're going to have to do it expeditiously. That concludes my testimony. I'd be happy to try and answer any questions the committee might have. Okay.
Thanks, Mr. Oxley. We do want to hear testimony. It's just that we're not going to be taking it right at this time. We're going to be presenting the bills, and then we will. Then we are looking for people to testify. So far, we have very few people that have signed up to testify, and only one person has signed up to testify today. We will be doing a walkthrough, a side-by-side of the four bills so that you will know the differences before we leave this evening, and that might help to generate some discussion, too. Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a question for you. Are we going to hear the rest of this bill at some point in the future?
Yes, Senator Dibble. The governor's bill also has other portions to it. And we're not taking an up or down vote on any of these bills at this time.
No, I understand. I read ahead a little bit and had some questions about other parts of the bill, so I was hoping to at some point in the future.
As we pick up those areas in our further on down the line during session, we will be taking up energy efficiency and carbon reduction and community energy development. All of those issues, and we will take the portions of this bill that are necessary at those times.
Great. Madam Chair, we appreciate that very much. I didn't imply that you weren't going to take my testimony. Okay. I just didn't want to go too far.
Have you signed up yet?
Are there any questions now?
Sign him up.
Any questions now for Senator Tomassoni and Mr. Oxley? Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members.
Now I'm going to turn the meeting over to the Vice Chair, Senator Dahl. We're going to take the governor's bill first.
We have Senator Prettner-Solon and Mike Bull, okay. Assistant Commissioner for Renewable Energy and Advanced Technologies from the Department of Commerce. Thank you for being here. I'm going to introduce the governor's bill.
Okay. Mr. Chair, the bill is Senate File 145. And I am going to – actually, it is also a very comprehensive bill. It's an omnibus bill. And it addresses a number of energy issues, but in this bill, we will only be addressing Section 2 again from the bottom of page 2 through the middle of page 8. And so I'm going to call on Mike Bull, Assistant Commissioner of Renewable Energy and Advanced Technologies from the Minnesota Department of Commerce.
Mike Bull.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I am Mike Bull. I'm the Assistant Commissioner for Renewable Energy at the Minnesota Department of Commerce, for the record. I just have a couple of brief introductory comments, and then I'll walk quickly through this this portion of the bill. We have an historic opportunity, a once-in-a generation opportunity, I think, this session, to really make significant changes in the way we look at energy issues here in Minnesota. And the governor recognized that opportunity and announced his next generation energy package. I've worked on these issues for a number of years, and this may be among the most, if not the most, progressive and comprehensive energy proposal from any Minnesota governor ever. And I think that sort of sets the stage for this once-in-a-lifetime, once-in-a-generation opportunity before us. Now, there are six major action items in that proposal for the legislature, and I know we're only going to be working on one currently, but I want to run through them just real quickly as a checklist. That we're looking at more than doubling our current renewable electricity targets in a way that protects ratepayers from adverse and unintended consequences. We're looking at doubling our energy savings from electric utilities and increasing our natural gas savings by 50%. We're looking at providing specific mechanisms to promote community-owned energy projects in the state. In addition, we're proposing to establish the platform for the coming cellulose bioenergy revolution, the next generation biofuels and the biogas opportunities that we're now hearing a lot about. We want to make E85 fuel available and convenient across the state, and we also want to require new fossil fuel generation to offset their carbon emissions before being allowed to sell those kilowatt hours here in Minnesota. So as the governor talked with you yesterday in the state of the state, we have this a comprehensive package, but we know you have your own ideas, and we want to work with you on those ideas and try to work through resolution on this. Some of these action items are going to be more difficult than others, but it's important that we work on all of them. That the success of this session is just how much progress we're able to make on this checklist, whether we're able to seize this historic opportunity and make the tremendous progress I think we all can make. As I was listening to the previous presenters, there is a high level of agreement on a lot of this already. And I think that the opportunity here is huge, and I really appreciate that. Our preference, as you know, is to work on a comprehensive package, but we understand that that's not necessarily the committee's preference, and we'll work with that. We want to work with the committee on a cooperative and bipartisan manner in order to do what we can. So quickly, I'll move through Article 2, Sections 1, I think, to 9 of the governor's proposal for you. The first sections deal with the governor's proposal for the next generation renewable energy objective. Minnesota's REO, as we've heard, is a unique in the nation program that combines the firmness that renewable energy advocates require in a renewable energy standard, combines that with the flexibility that utilities and their customers value in order to minimize cost and reliability impacts from renewable mandates. This combination allows a more targeted and ratepayer-friendly approach to increasing the amount of renewable energy that a utility provides to its Minnesota consumers than a one-size-fits-all approach of RES standards in other states. So Minnesota's REO is, we refer to it as the smart renewable standard in that it allows it's a good faith effort requirement. It's not a voluntary approach. It never has been. That good faith effort is a reasonableness requirement. It requires the utilities to do everything they reasonably can to add the targets, to add renewables to meet the targets. And that reasonableness standard allows the REO to be calibrated to a particular utilities situation, what it's facing in terms of the load growth, what it's facing in terms of the technology that it can employ to meet the REO, and that reasonableness standard allows us to avoid unreasonable requirements on the utilities and therefore protect Minnesota ratepayers from those adverse consequences. So walking through section by section real quickly, section one, as a general rule, retains the current definitions for eligible renewable resources, but increases, as the others, many of the others have, the size of eligible hydro resources from 60 to 100 megawatts. However, the bill does allow the Public Utilities Commission to count additional large hydro, currently non-eligible hydro, in order to if it's found that that's necessary in order to minimize excessive rate impacts to a utility's consumers. This is one of the ways we're looking to make the REO. You know, we're proposing, this would be, as I think in Senator Anderson's proposal would as well, be the most aggressive standards in the country. And what we're talking about is setting a policy for Minnesota for the next 20 years. And so we're trying to think about things that we can put in the bill today that will protect ratepayers down the road. If we never have to use them, as Senator Anderson mentioned with regard to the penalties, we think that would be tremendous. But we want to make sure that we're thinking ahead and trying to do this smart. We're also looking to increase the REO to 25% from the current 10% by 2025, with interim steps of 10% by 2010, 15% by 2015, and 20% by 2020. Section 3 would make it explicit that the PUC is to review compliance with each utility's of each REO utility every 2 years and make a determination as to whether it's compliance with the good faith, it's in compliance with the good faith effort requirement. And if a utility is found to be making the good faith effort but falling short of the target, it would be required to file a plan to make up the shortfall. And if it's found not to be making that required effort, it would be subject to a penalty, a substantial penalty, and I'll get to that in a moment. Section 4 would put into law the criteria and standards adopted by the Public Utilities Commission for demonstrating compliance with the good faith effort requirement, and specifies what I've told you here today, that the good faith effort means that the utility has taken all reasonable steps to meet the REO while minimizing adverse reliability and cost impacts to Minnesota consumers. Section 5 is the penalty section, and we've all happened upon the same level of penalty. This comes from the Texas RES, which I think has become sort of an industry standard for what's necessary in terms of a penalty, in order to make sure that it's a big enough disincentive for the utilities so that they do what's required, but not overly burdensome if they don't. Section 6 authorizes a compliance payment option to utilities in lieu of adding additional generation resources to meet that next increment of the REO that it's facing, if the commission finds that payment would be in the best interest of the utility and its ratepayers. This is another provision that we're trying to think of the impacts to ratepayers and making sure that we're ahead of the game on that. Section 7 would provide for a couple of specific mechanisms to promote community energy in Minnesota. There's a full article in the rest of the bill on a number of other provisions to promote community energy, but this provision is within the operation of the REO itself. And these community energy projects, the local ownership of community energy and the the benefit, local benefit of energy production is critically important to this administration's energy policy. It starts with the farmer-owned co-op ethanol plants and the economic anchors that those plants have been to Minnesota's rural economy and these types of community energy projects. Will have that same benefit to stabilize those rural economies. So a couple of provisions here. We would look to require the utilities to manage the contracts that they enter into to meet the renewable energy obligations in such a way that 25% of the payout in the aggregate of those contracts stays here in Minnesota, that that those monies flow to community investors. And so we're looking at following the money from those contracts. There'll be other proposals, I think, to carve out a certain megawattage of for community energy projects, and we'd be open to working on that as well. But this approach would allow a great deal more flexibility to the utilities and to the industry to develop projects that. That will meet this requirement. We're also looking at counting a kilowatt hour of community energy more toward the REO than non-community energy, so that a kilowatt hour would count 1.2 kilowatt hours toward the REO, in recognition that these community energy projects both are more difficult for a utility to manage, and I'd be straight up about that. They're very hard. And the utilities are doing a pretty decent job in working on that. But also they recognize the fact that these projects are more valuable to the state. And we would want to encourage those within the REO. Section 8 is the Next Generation Energy Fund. There's a provisions that are outside this article that also impact on this. But this is where the compliance payments and the penalties would be made into, and we would use the funds in that, the money in that Next Generation Energy Fund to finance renewable projects in the state. Section 9, we're looking at giving a push for the next increment of transmission necessary to serve the REO, as well as there is a national goal of having 20% of the electricity used nationally come from wind energy. And in order to do that, we're going to have to unlock, to a large extent, the wind resource in the Midwest. And what we're asking the utilities to do from our state, and I think the states in the region will comply as well, is to get together and plan for how to do that, how to unlock the Midwest wind resource to bring that resource to the rest of the country. And so that's what Subdivision 2 of the last section, Section 9, does. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just want to reiterate the policy goals, I think, that have been expressed here today, Senator Anderson and Senator Solon, Senator Tomasoni, I think the governor would, the administration would echo to a very great extent. And I really appreciate the time that you're taking to work on these issues.
Thank you, Mr. Bull. Senator Pretner Solon, is there anything you'd like to add?
No, there's nothing I want to add at this time.
Okay. Any questions from the members? Senator Dibble?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Bull, if you could just touch, and I apologize if I missed it, on this issue that or the subject that Senator Anderson raised in her bill, which was the whole subject of counting what exists versus counting new. Does your bill speak to that?
Mr. Bull?
Or does the governor's bill
Mr.
speak to
Chair,
that?
Mr. Chair, Senator Dibble, we don't. We've decided to leave that issue aside for now. It's a couple hundred megawatts of old hydro. And we dealt with that question in a different way. We would allow it to continue to count. We've increased, you know, the proposal that Senator Anderson brought forward last year was 20% by 2020. Our proposal was 25% by 2025 and this year's proposal from it was 25% by 2020. So there's a lot of working that's going on in leveraging that what that percentage is and what numbers count toward that. And we'd be happy to work through those issues. Those are not fall on your sword kinds of questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If I could just comment. Yeah, I would be interested in knowing from someone, you know, if we don't count, if we do count the old, then how much new do we get? What are we effectively, you know, should we reframe it to pilot 17 by 2025? Or, you know, I'd just be curious to know what the real numbers would be if we count what exists presently. Yeah. And we can deal with that later.
Senator Anderson?
Mr. Chair and Senator Dibble, I think that's a really good point, and maybe we could get some of the folks, the smart people in this room, to put together a chart for us. I know it can be quantified in terms of megawatts of wind. If you did the whole thing in wind, you know, if you count something that's old, how much less wind would we get? Mm-hmm. So there's different ways of computing it, but I think that would be useful information to have in front of us. And I just, if I may ask a question.
Yes, Senator Anderson.
On the issue of you put in this provision that says that you can count large hydro if it's minimizes the rain impact. Have you thought about whether that would be a tradable? Is that something you could count as a tradable credit? If say one utility was able to count some big hydro projects, would then they be able to sell those as credits, and other utilities maybe wouldn't be able to count those as credit? So have you thought about that?
Mr. Bull.
Mr. Chair, Senator Anderson, I think our plan would be that those would be only the kilowatt hours that the utility is purchasing, the energy itself, and as opposed to the credits.
Okay.
Senator Anderson?
Mr. Chair, I do want to compliment Mr. Bull and the governor for putting together, and Mr. Garvey, Commissioner Garvey, for putting together this is a comprehensive and progressive, forward-looking proposal. And I really appreciate that, and that we do have some bipartisan support for these ideas this year is a really good thing. We might disagree on a few of the details, but we're pretty darn close on a lot of them.
Mr. Bull?
Mr. Chair, Senator Anderson, I would agree. And I also want to echo something that Mr. Noble said, that you have been a tireless advocate for community energy. And I do want to recognize that. And I think that we're going to be able to make some incredible progress on that front this session as well.
Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Assistant Commissioner, I will second that, too. When Senator Anderson talks about energy, her eyes start to sparkle, I told her. She starts to foam.
Energy geek. Yeah.
But my question to you, Mr. Bull, is the PUC's authority on the good faith effort, are we going to allow the PUC to develop their guidelines? Are we going to have jurisdiction over that? How does that happen?
Mr. Bull.
Mr. Chair, Senator Rosen, what we've done here in this proposal is back in 2003, we directed the commission to establish specific criteria and standards by which they would judge good faith compliance. And they did that, and they did a very good job. And what we've taken is those criteria and standards, and we've placed those into statute so that it's clear what is required.
And Mr. Chair, if I may,
Senator Rosen.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Bull. You talk about Section 1, what renewable energy sources there are. Do we have to keep that so tight? I mean, are there other energy sources that could be coming down the pipeline that we can expand? I mentioned peat the other day. I mean, it is a possibility, but it is explicitly listed in here, and I think there are some other options out there.
Mr. Bull?
Mr. Chair, Senator Rosen, the interesting question about peat is that it's not excluded by the statute. By my reading, it was excluded by the commission's order. So that's maybe a thought that to consider. They just determined that it was not biomass. And that was a commission interpretation. So I would be interested in what else might be added to the list, and we could talk about it.
Thank you, Mr. Bill. Members, we're going to have plenty of time to, I guess, take more questions. We need to move on or for the shortness of time. Senator Prender-Solon, did you have anything else you wanted to add here?
No, I'm ready for my bill, Mr.
Thank you.
Chair.
And we'll move on.
You're
going to present Senate File 74?
Yes, thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I do have an author's amendment. Thanks.
Oh, yes.
The A2 amendment that puts it in the final form.
There is a quorum present here, I believe, and the senator would like to explain the amendment.
Basically, it just puts it in the form that I'd like it to be heard.
Not today. We'll get to it.
I'll go through it as I...
Senator Prender-Solon, go ahead.
No, I'll go through it when I go through the bill. It's an author's
amendment.
Are
there any questions regarding the amendment? I will take a vote on that. All in favor say aye.
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 Opposed say nay. Amendment is passed.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And at this time, I'll go through Senate File 74, and I will do this very quickly. It is there are a few changes from some of the bills that have been introduced, and it's based on the very same premises that have already been addressed. On page 1, line 9, we have a technical drafting change. On page 1, line 13, the capacity of a hydroelectric facility that can count towards satisfying a renewable energy objective is increased from 60 to 100 megawatts, as in some of the other bills. On page 2, line 7 to 13, the renewable energy objective is increased from 10% in 2015 by an unspecified annual percentage starting in 2015 and reaching an unspecified total percentage in 2020. And the very premise of my bill is that I want us to be able to achieve as high a renewable standard and to shoot for as high a renewable standard as we can in our state, taking into account reliability, cost, and technical feasibility concerns. This bill does not change the terminology of the current law from a good faith objective to a standard. Page 2, line 14 to 24 repeals the requirement that a portion of the objective must be met with biomass fuel generation. It still allows for biomass fuel generation. Page 2, line 32 to page 3, line 2 eliminates the concept of weighting renewable technologies so that some count more towards satisfying the objective. And the Public Utilities Commission, exercising the discretion granted to them, has decided not to implement this provision anyways. Page 3, lines 3 to 8, authorizes the PUC to increase an electric utilities objective if it finds that it is increased, that by increasing it is in the public interest. So this doesn't hold them, everybody, to the same standard. We may have a 20 or 25% standard in the state, but it could allow the PUC to increase a particular utility to 26 or 28 or 30 if they have the capability of being able to generate and transmit more renewable energy. Page 3, lines 9 to 17 authorizes the commission to delay or modify an objective if it finds compliance would not be in the public interest based on reliability, cost, or technical feasibility concerns. And this is, again, Senator Sparks' amendment from last year. The commission may consider an electric utility's load growth when it makes its public interest determination. The commission must give strong consideration to the legislative preference for achieving the objective and for renewable energy when it makes its public interest determination of whether to delay or modify an objective. Page 3, line 31, requires compliance information be reported to the legislature on a utility-by-utility basis. Page 3, line 36, requires the PUC to establish a program for tradable credits rather than just authorizing them to do so, as is provided by current law, and it has taken them, well, they have not done this, and so this is placing in law that they must establish a program. Page 4, line 6 clarifies that tradable credits
that may satisfy an objective include those issued by other states. Page 4, lines 12 to 14, authorizes the PUC to consider, among other factors, whether a tradable credit program exists when determining whether to modify or delay a particular utility's objective. So it may say, well, there are tradable credits out there. You can trade for them rather than delaying their meeting the objective. Page 5, lines 15 to 22, creates a new subdivision 7 that provides enforcement authority to the PUC and authorizes a penalty. Page 5, lines 23 to 27, creates a new subdivision 8. And actually, this speaks to my amendment. And basically what it says is that, oh, no, I'm sorry.
The committee chair. I've been there, done that, yeah.
Yeah, let's see, I was talking about my amendment. This basically makes the penalty the amount that the electric utility would have had to expend to achieve compliance. Let's see, where was I? Page 5, line 23 to 27 creates a new subdivision 8, which requires the Commissioner of Commerce to promptly notify the legislature of certain changes in federal law that could require legislative action with respect to the renewable energy objective, because there is the possibility of the feds creating a renewable energy objective, and so this would then require us to come into compliance. I don't even know how to turn it off, unfortunately.
Yeah, same.
Just stays on.
I had the same.
Page 5, lines 28 to 36 is a section that requires the Commissioner of Commerce to report to the legislature concerning the effect, if any, that excess utility investments under the Conservation Investment Program should have on the utility's compliance with its objective. There was a suggestion that maybe those utilities that have met the conservation requirement and go beyond that could use some of that to offset their renewable energy objective. Page 6, lines 1 to 17, is a section directing various state agencies to develop and report to the legislature a strategy to optimize the state economic benefit from the activities required under the renewable energy objective law. And actually, this was a small proposal that Senator Dahl had requested, and we're likely to remove this and deal with it separately. And that is it.
All right. Any quick questions from the members? Right. Thank you, Senator Pretner-Solon. I'll return the
chair
back to you.
No, it's me. Well, your turn.
At this time, we have one speaker that has signed up to testify today. I think people have been waiting to find out what's going to happen in the stakeholders' meetings, and I'm not sure how many of you are aware of this, but we, the staff and stakeholders, will be meeting to identify where there is agreement on issues, where there are differences, where we can compromise, and to see, you know, what position we can put together as a whole. They will start meeting tomorrow, and so I think that's probably why people have not signed up to testify. While I'm speaking, I'm going to call Mr. Doug Peterson to the table so that he can testify.
It's a good evening. I think it's evening.
Just one moment, please.
Okay.
And so I anticipate that we're going to have more speakers on Tuesday, but it is important that you do notify Jenny, the committee administrator, if you want to testify on Tuesday. And also, if you think that you'd like to participate in the stakeholders meeting, then also notify Jenny, and she can give you the details. So,
Madam Chair, my comments tonight, I'm Doug Peterson. I'm president of the Minnesota Farmers Union. And my comments tonight would be directed at Senate File 4, Senator Anderson, Ellen Anderson's bill. And some of the things that I want to speak to really deal with the farmers who are the resource owners in the state of Minnesota because of transmission lines and where the power poles are put, and also because of their interest in community wind, not only ownership of local resources, but also the fact that this is, in our opinion, from our organization, a grassroots organization that's been going on since 1929, the economic development. And I think the press conference yesterday, Representative Aaron Peterson said it best, this is the situation about economic survival, not necessarily a new twist out there in rural Minnesota. So my prepared comments simply will be, on behalf of the membership of the Minnesota Farmers Union, I am here to urge you to in support of Senator Anderson, House File 4, excuse me, that's the old House language, excuse me, throwback. Support of Senate File 4, authored by Senator Anderson, would establish a renewable energy standard in Minnesota, attaining 25% of Minnesota's energy from wind power and other sources, such as biomass, year 2020. Our Farmers Union organization is proud to have been a strong supporter of this legislation in renewable fuels, and for quite some time we've supported it. With the standard, the Farmers Union sees the same potential with wind and energy and biomass that we've seen in development of ethanol and biodiesel in the state. Just yesterday I sat in Ag Committee in the Senate, and I heard Commissioner Hugesson talk about a $5 billion industry in ethanol in the state of Minnesota. And if we look at 14 plants, and if we look at $30 million per plant, which was a 20 cents a gallon producer payment, some of those bills that I was chief author was when I was in the House, that $450 million, ladies and gentlemen and senators, has ballooned into a $5 billion economic activity. And a lot of people on this committee were in support of that. I think Senator Rest was there for it, and I really appreciate that way back when. It's a real positive impact on rural Minnesota and the rural economy, and also the environment. In discussing the idea of a standard, I believe it would have a similar impact, like I said before, on the ethanol mandate that had on our economy. And I want to make the point clear. If we would have not have mandated ethanol in the state of Minnesota, this would not have happened. That industry would not have happened, and Minnesota would not be a leader in ethanol. It's that simple and plain. It's called the Minnesota model. And I have some history in the legislature. I've spent 12 years in the House. In 1993, just a little anecdotal thing, 1993, I had a bill that outlawed party lines in the state of Minnesota. 1993. 3 years later, we had a computer at our house. So this technology is going to move forward at rapid pace. And that was a mandate. That cost some money, but, you know, that was a survival instinct for being out in the individual divide. Our support of this legislation is truly from our grassroots, our membership. We have visited with our members extensively about this issue, and we think it's very important because if we're going to have 3,000 wind turbines in the state, they're most likely going to go on farmland. And the people that I represent are here to tell you that we're very excited about the opportunity that this has for us in rural Minnesota. I know there's going to be some issues such as eminent domain and those things, and I think there's a lot of things that were done last year in the legislature that addressed that, yet there's still some things to be done on that. Minnesota has seen a tremendous increase, especially in southwest Minnesota, with our members that are being directly involved with wind energy production. Farmers Union members have started their own projects, partners with others, and also formed a cooperative to enter into wind production. More and more farmers are looking at wind energy as a way to add value to their farm and increase profits, which also keeps the next generation on the farm. But also, that money is generated locally and it stays in rural Minnesota. Madam Chair and Committee, in closing, I just want to urge your consideration of Senate File 4 by passing the language. The Minnesota State Senate will ensure the farmers and rural communities will have the opportunity to thrive in Minnesota by producing efficient, clean energy that will also deliver an economic advantage and development to rural Minnesota, and I'll stand for questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson. Senator Olsen.
I thought when you said that, you meant that we'd be a nonpartisan body when you said to remove party lines.
Oh! I'm sorry. Madam Chair, maybe I have to explain party lines.
No, actually, in listening to you talking about farmers organizing together and forming companies to generate these or to have the windmills, I suppose because it'd be cost prohibitive, but the transmission seems to be an issue. Would it be feasible for them to build their own lines and charge a wheelage or wheeling, I guess it is?
I'm not a real technical expert on transmission lines, but I know for a fact that if you can provide the incentives, as I understand the issue with rural Minnesota is that the capacity and transmission lines are now are mostly REC's, rural electric co-ops. Those rural electric co-ops have stranded costs and they have maintenance costs. With a diminished population, you have to have an incentive there to allow those co-ops to move forward and to either be a co-op of ownership so that they can deliver that power to those people at a reduced cost. And I think we heard earlier today that it doesn't cost us anymore, but the issue in rural Minnesota is can we have the capacity? How do we incentivize the bill to make it a capacity issue, and how do we get those jobs with the turbines, with the concrete in the ground, and the lines and the transmission in Minnesota? It's a huge thing. And if you start looking farther down the road with wind and the technology of hydrogen and production of fertilizer and hydrogen fuel cells, this has potential unmasked in anywhere in the whole country. We have fallen behind a little bit in this, but I think, you know, with this standard, and not to criticize the chairman's bill or the governor's bill, but to tell you the truth, we need to move on that. And my observation, as I heard some of the earlier testimony, is that there seems to be a lot of questions about can we do this and that and this, you know. I heard a lot of that stuff when I was doing the ethanol bills. And my question to you and to the state of Minnesota, if not now, when? If not now, when are we going to do it? We can take command, we can be the leader in this, or we can fall behind, and we can watch dollars go to Pennsylvania, dollars go to Texas. I think it's terribly important for rural people. And the other part of it is there's going to be an increased demand for energy throughout the whole country. If you look at all of the charts, it's going to be there. And the other issue on this is carbon. We are going to have to sequester carbon because of global warming, but wind is going to be part of it. Methane digesters are going to be part of it, grasslands, those kinds of things, minimum tillage. And that's the farmer component of this whole issue on energy and conservation and moving forward to have independence.
Thank you, Mr. Peterson.
Thank you.
Okay. At this time, you have in your package a comparison of the four bills. And I'm going to ask Mr. Fuller to walk us through these.
Madam Chair, members, this is not exhaustive, but it tries to touch the more significant issues. So you'll see there's across the top it'll say which bill, and then there's boxes that have titles. So the first one says renewables counting. See, the Senate File 4 increases hydropower from 60 to 100. Every bill does that. Under the governor's bill, the hydroelectric facility of any capacity may count if necessary to minimize excessive rate impact on its customers. Okay. On the Anderson bill, except for hydropower and biomass facilities within the state, the facilities must have been installed by January 1, 75. A somewhat similar provision in the Thomas-Soney bill, Senate File 129. I think you can read that. Next box, three of the bills eliminate the biomass set aside. Size of proposal, I think that's self-explanatory. I won't walk through the numbers. It compares the different numbers and the time frames. The label to describe the obligation, you see that Senate File 4 changes to a standard. 74 retains good faith effort. The governor retains good faith effort. And Thomas-Soney converts to a standard. I think one of the most important things to consider is the next box, the authority given to the PUC to modify a standard or objective. That is critical. And so in Senate File 4, it provides that the PUC must modify or delay an objective or standard if compliance is not in the public interest, because compliance will either produce undesirable impacts on the reliability of the utility system or on the utility's ratepayers, or is not technically feasible. Senate File 74, the Pretner-Solon bill, doesn't require a modification or delay, but authorizes it under the same set of circumstances as in Senate File 4, Senator Anderson's proposal. And in addition, while they're making that decision about whether to delay or modify, they have to give strong consideration to the preference for renewables. And then furthermore, the commission may increase a utility's objective if it finds it in the public interest, and there's some tests for that. So that's the only bill that talks about going beyond the statutory set limits. And the commission may also consider a utility's load growth and the availability of a tradable credit system when making its delay or modification decision. In the governor's proposal, it retains the good faith. It defines it as, and this is what the utility has to do, so that's their obligation, and they meet that obligation if they've taken all reasonable steps to meet the objective, while minimizing adverse reliability and cost impacts. Pulls into the statute those criteria the PUC has set by order to determine whether there's good faith, which are practical criteria. What are they doing? They look at what they're doing. Does it seem like they're making an effort? It also allows other factors to be considered. The Tomasoni bill requires the PUC to delay or modify a standard if complying is not in the public interest. They establish a set of factors that the commission can consider when making that determination. The last sentence there, that the commission is bound by the findings of the governing body of the municipality or the cooperative with respect to those factors, with findings of facts, is an important provision, because it passes on some of that authority, whether to delay or modify, in effect to the local governing body. Compliance, we've heard a lot about. I think the issues are, you know, should the penalty be mandatory or discretionary? Several of the bills make it mandatory. Should it just be the authority to do it, or do they have to do it? What's the size of the penalty? They're different. And then what do you do with the penalty? I think the governor's bill puts it in the fund. If you collect the penalty, should it go towards doing renewable energy, or should it go to the general fund? So I think that's self-explanatory as well. You can read those differences. The weighted scale of renewables, nobody likes. Okay, that's gone. Electric utilities are subject to law. No change in any of the bills. Tradable credit program. Two of the bills, the Anderson bill and the governor's bill, Senator Anderson's bill, the governor's bill, keep the current law. The Senate File 74, the Senator Pretner-Solon bill, and the Tomasoni bill require the commission to establish a tradable credit program now. It's been problematic because they can't develop a tracking system, but we heard in their testimony that they think they'll have a system up and running this July, I think. So, and then the other provisions, I think we heard the Senate File 74, report and study in the wisdom allowing SIP investments to count in some way towards the renewable objective, and the second one, to develop a strategy on economic developments being spun off of this bill. And then on the governors, there's three of them. Authority to make a compliance payment. Utility makes a decision and gets approval from the PUC that it's in the best interest to just make a payment to a fund that will then use that money to develop renewable resources. Number two was the community development. A utility must make a good faith effort so that at least 25% of the purchases they make for the wind, essentially doesn't say that, but it's wind, is directed towards these community-based projects. And then a spiff is given for the utility of 20%, that every 1 kilowatt hour purchase under such a contract counts for 1.2. And then finally, they established the next generation fund, which is what some of the penalties will be paid into, and then given out by grants by the Commissioner of Commerce for renewable energy projects. And then finally, there's a provision that was talked about planning for transmission for renewables in this 20,000 megawatt export from the Midwest, extra high voltage power lines. So if there are any questions, I think if you read it over, you'll see that there's common topics that are addressed in somewhat different ways, and some of those different ways are extremely significant. I would say the most extremely significant ones are obviously the years and the numbers and the standard for excusing or modifying an objective or standard or mandate.
Thank you, Mr. Fuller. Are there any questions by committee members or comments? Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I was just wondering, I know you've talked about the process on how this is going to work, and we know the common ground. Are we going to have a mini-conference committee? We have so many, have a large agenda here. How are we going to get this?
Well, as I said, the stakeholders are going to be meeting with the staff to walk through the side-by-sides and to identify where they have common ground or where they can make some agreement on things, what portions of the bills can be accepted, which are difficult to accept. Are there places that compromises can be made? We will hopefully hear some progress on Tuesday.
Other issues that may come up that aren't addressed today, such as what is Excel's obligation to the audience?
Yeah, Mr. Fuller is reminding me that there are other issues that might come up also that during the stakeholder meetings and that will have to be discussed. And those things will be brought to the committee. I think that the goal here is to have a delete all amendment that we would work off of. Okay. Comments, questions? Do new members know what a delete all amendment is?
No.
I don't.
A delete all means that you would delete out everything but perhaps the title and the number of the bill and then replace it with the language that is agreed upon by the committee. I see some questions on faces and things. Senator Dibble.
Thanks. Well, I'm wondering if I'm a stakeholder. I'm wondering about the committee process. I'm glad that the stakeholders are going to meet, and that's important. But I'm wondering about, kind of our deliberation and the process you envision for that.
Well, I've been trying to encourage people to start talking about their ideas. I was hoping that we would have more time actually today to do some of that. But we will have time on Tuesday and we'll have time on Thursday.
Great. Okay. Thank you.
Senator Rest.
Madam Chair, is the delete all going to be to Senator Anderson's bill?
Actually, we haven't talked about that, but I've asked Senator Anderson if she would consider that. I'm hoping that she would consider that.
Okay. Thank you.
Questions? Okay, there being no further business come before the committee, the meeting is adjourned.
I better.